right. Well, here we are. To dream again. To dare again. To feel enjoyment and happiness again. Or for the first time. To realize this is living. Be inspired. To see your life as an exciting journey of discovery. With your host of the Inspire Possibility Show, Mark Sussman.
Hi, everybody. This is Mark Sussman, and you're listening to the Inspire Possibility Show. Every week, I have a conversation with various individuals that I consider cutting-edge thought leaders, people who can inspire us, can teach us, and entertain us at the same time. And that's quite a statement to educate us, to teach us, and to entertain us. And I think some of the best people that can do that are storytellers. And there's a storyteller, a mythologist, somebody that some of you probably know about. He's a scholar of mythology, anthropology, and psychology, and he combines hypnotic storytelling, street-savvy perceptiveness, and spellbinding interpretations of ancient myths and a deep knowledge of cross-cultural rituals. He's an unusual person. His name's Michael Mead. He has mosaic voices, and he's an inspiration, and I'm sure that you'll agree with me. So welcome to the Inspire Possibility Show, Michael, and I've been looking forward to having this conversation about storytelling. I've looked at this. You've been interviewed in the Huffington Post, Sun Magazine that I'm familiar with, and what's it like to be a storyteller?
Good to be with you, Mark. It's a
well,
great
thank
thing,
you.
You know, in my case, I would say there is no choice, in a sense. So, you know, part of what I've worked on is what people are called to do with their lives. And I got called into storytelling at a pretty young age, and it saved my life. And so I would say being a storyteller is a great thing. And, and one of the oldest things, if you imagine that humans are natural storytellers, for instance, every tribe that I've been able to study anywhere on Earth, including tribes in the Amazon that might only have 120 members in the tribe, have to create a story that explains the entire world. So humans are not only natural storytellers, we are the only cosmologists, and we are mythologists naturally as well.
Do you think that almost everybody has a story that more or less runs their life, which is kind of a belief system?
Well, okay, so myth has two meanings, you could say. There's two levels of myth. One level of myth is where in modern world myth means something false, right? It's just a myth. So that's the first level of myth, where we tell ourselves stories that aren't true. Oh, of course, it's completely the subject of national dialogue in America right now.
Right.
Storytelling, fake news. It has become the story we're having to live through. And then the second level of myth, the deeper level of myth, the deeper meaning of myth, is emerging truth. So on the surface, myth would seem to mean something not true, but the deeper meaning is the universal truths that are always emerging in our lives. And so you could say on a personal level, everyone has a story inside themselves that is trying to unfold and lead them through the world. That's their personal myth. But most people have no idea that it's there. So most people think, told them about themselves or the impression they gathered from the world. And not most people don't know they are carrying a deeper story, a kind of personal myth that could actually lead them into the meaningful direction that their life was aimed at even before they were born.
So how does someone discover what they're called to do? What they're what I'm getting is a person's deeper myth that has been there a long time and what they're called to do. It's almost the same thing. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, they're related. The way I put it, so the most recent book I wrote is The Genius Myth. And I'm using genius in its original meaning, its oldest meaning, which is the spirit that's already there. In the root meaning of genius has nothing to do with IQ and has nothing to do even with specific gift or talent. It really means the spirit that's already there when a person is born. And so once you understand that there's something inside each of us that is there when we're born and really from before we're born, then you can understand calling. Because calling is calling to that part of us that brought us to life. Calling is calling to the genius inside of us. And the genius inside of us is the one that knows the story and the direction that we're supposed to live in. So going back to your original question to me, what's it like to be a storyteller? I found out I was a storyteller in an unusual way. I grew up in New York City. I was about 13 and a half years old.
Yeah, I can tell.
it's still there, yeah. I was about 13 and a half years old, and in my neighborhood, rough neighborhood, you had to join a local, we call them crews, but, you know, it was a gang. And
right.
Our little 13-year-old gang, one of the guys in it, had started trouble with an older, very dangerous gang. And they came looking for him. When they couldn't find him, they found me inside a movie theater. And I got up and went walking up to the bathroom. And they followed me. And all of a sudden, inside the bathroom, I'm surrounded by seven older guys with weapons. And they're telling me, we're going to really do damage to you because of what your friend said about us. And if I would explain it psychologically, I would say that seeing the danger and trauma coming, my ego departed. And when my ego departed, I suddenly started telling a story. It wasn't conscious. It wasn't a planned or a rehearsed story. Words, whole sentences, paragraphs just poured out of my mouth. And I so compelled them with story that they kind of forgot to hurt me. And they wound up just letting me go. And so that's why I say story saved my life. And I found out at that early age that stories are more powerful than weapons. And that and that there was something inside me that I wasn't aware of, my family wasn't aware of. I mean, I was a talker, but no one knew that stories could spontaneously erupt
right.
in me. And right. I, at that point, got a glimmer of what my life was about. It took me about 20 years to figure out how to live with it.
Right.
But, so there you have.
So your background, you were involved in the men's movement, and you were what connected with Robert Bly back in those days, or was that?
Well, the story that was a kind of a moment in I guess national history there, where people for a very, very brief period of time were interested. Some people became interested in how do men grow their souls. And
right.
so there's lots of stories to it, but the backstory, the background story was that I had met Robert Bly, and he was interested in the fact that I'd always while playing drums, and he was teaching poets
right.
how to write poems and asked me to teach the poets how to find rhythm. And then after we worked together for a while, I had this interest in James Hillman's work in depth psychology. So I invited him to come. And the next thing, the three of us were doing these amazing events, many of which were primarily for men. And then that started to be called the men's movement. Although at the time I said, no, it's not a men's movement. We already have a men's movement because the United States Congress. We don't need another one. That
well, there you
actually
go.
What this is. What this really was the old idea of soul work. And the idea is that a man, a young guy can't become a man if they don't learn about their soul. That was the kind of core idea of it. And you see it now. when you have a president who is like an uneducated adolescent, just acting out power
right.
and misogyny and all these things that are kind of in an adolescent psychological mode. And so we were working on the idea of how to bring men back into contact with soul, because that's how you grow a person, but also that's how you limit the violence, misogyny, and some of the cruelty that can come with becoming a man and feeling powerful.
So, you know what I'm curious about is that you use the word soul a lot, and I do too in my work, and my new book's The Soul of Uncertainty. And so I've always looking at what does that mean? What does the word soul mean? And do you distinguish that from the word spirit? How do you make that distinction?
Yeah, the classic separation is that spirit is connected to fire and air and wants to ascend. And when spirit ascends, it's aiming for that unifying one point. Some people call it God, others call it the universal principle. Spirit is heading for that, ascending, and it's unifying under the great one. Soul is connected to water and earth, and it's descending. And as it descends, it's becoming multiple. So that soul is connected to the multiplicity of life, to the diversity of life, to the multicultural elements of life. Just like a forest that has to be diverse to exist, soul is like the forest, and spirit is like the heavens. And so they're different. They're both necessary. And one way I talk about it is to say, secretly, spirit is trying to have a meeting with soul or a romance with soul. That when there isn't enough soul, things get dried out. They get too high. They get unrelated to other people. They get unrelated to the animal world, to the nature world. The whole Western experience, modern experience, is a spirit-driven experience. And usually what's missing in modern culture is soul. Usually what's missing in mass religions is soul. Soul is usually the missing ingredient. Soul is like the glue of the world, the thing that connects one thing to another. Energetically, soul is connected to Eros, the erotic connections of the world, the things we love, the things that we want to be near are soulful. And spirit is connected to the kind of idea level of the world, the knowledge level of the world. But secretly,
yeah,
they want to come together.
Yeah, I kind of think of it as kind of core essence of who we are, that connection. Like in music, sometimes you hear somebody and you say, wow, man, they have soul. And do you think it in that way too? Is that kind of, are we saying the same thing, or do you see a distinction?
Yeah. No, what I would do is maybe a little refinement in the sense that soul is the essence. It's the invisible substance. It's the core, yes. Without your soul, you're not even a person. And that happens. You know, people lose their soul or their soul gets fragmented through trauma, through being in war or through being a refugee. You get people that can't find their soul again. But the refinement I would make, because soul and spirit are actually secretly connected, inside the soul is a spirit. And the spirit inside the soul used to be called genius. So genius is the resident spirit inside the soul. And when a person finds their soul in a deep, deep way, they suddenly are in touch with the spirit that's trying to live through them. So that a person needs both soulful connections, and soul grounds people. It gets people in touch with what's below and beneath them, both the inner psyche and the ground around them. But then the big surprise is when you're grounded, spirit awakens from inside. Another old meaning of soul was the light hidden inside the dark. So they both are the light and the dark. But American life, modern life, missing soul. soul is the lacking ingredient. I'm with you on that.
Good. Well, what I want to do is come back to one of the things you first said about where this genius idea that we're, when we're born, the genius is born inside of us. We are born with that genius. And then, and it isn't our challenge to somehow, when you're talking about what we're called to do, because I talk a lot about that too, about the calling inside us, that voice, that yearning of the soul, is how do we, so isn't our job somehow is to untap that genius that we're born with? Isn't that really what we're, the path we're on? Maybe that's really the hero's journey. I don't know. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I do think about that. And so I wrote this book, The Genius Myth, as a contrast to the hero's journey. And so it's a little bit tricky here, but here's how I got to that. You know, I worked briefly with Joseph Campbell, and I was studying his stuff starting in like 1965, 66.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a hero. He was a hero of mine. But he called the hero's journey the monomyth, the singular myth. And truth to tell, mythology is a multiplicity, and there is no single myth. So that's applying spirit to a condition of the soul, in a sense. But anyway, what has happened, I think, and I like this hero's journey, and it's valuable stage and place for people to consider their lives, but it tends to be masculine in tone. It tends to be outer-directed. It tends to be connected to winning and succeeding. And it tends to not have enough feminine connectedness. And you can go on looking at limitations of the heroic mode. And heroicism is kind of what has gotten us into so much trouble, thinking that we can heroically dominate the world, thinking that we can heroically fix things everywhere we go. And so I took a different path and said, genius is there inside a person to begin with. So even if you don't succeed in the outer world, you could be developing the genius in the inner world. Genius is diverse by nature. Therefore, it includes not just women and men. It includes femininity, and all places on the arc of gender are automatically included. So in a modern world where gender is getting redefined in its multiplicity, genius is closer to that idea that everybody has something valuable than the hero, I would say. And the journey now, I think, has to be understood as much interior as it is exterior. In other words, one of the great gifts of the Eastern world to modern America, by bringing in yoga and all kinds of related things, what also has come into America, which is extremely extroverted as a society, what has come in is a greater sense of interior value. And so genius is an inner thing that people already have that needs to be awakened, not necessarily found in the outside world. So that's
right.
The move I'm making with genius as a diverse move, perhaps, onward from the hero.
Right. I guess what I'm thinking about is that inner calling, for example, if you're a writer or a storyteller,
yeah,
like you are, and a writer, or a musician, there's that calling inside, that yearning of the soul, which I've had my whole life because I've been doing these things since I've been a kid, and I've always had a day job. But it's that inner thing that where you just have to do it. In fact, yeah, I interviewed David Cutler, who is the senior editor for the Joseph Campbell Foundation, and he was talking about that the idea of follow your bliss came from Joseph Campbell, where it's that thing you just have to do. You just have to do it because that's inside you. And I think in a way, to me, that is courageous, to do that thing that maybe there's not any reward in the external world, but you do it because you just have to do it. It makes you whole.
Yeah, so, yeah. Yeah, people call it their passion. In a world of stories, it's more about an inner gift, or the inner gold is a way to talk about it, that everybody has something golden. So back to the soul, that the realm of the soul would include some hidden gold. And so for some people, the first time they pick up a musical instrument, they find the golden thing in themselves. You know, some people pick up musical instrument, have no idea what to do. Someone else picks it up and they can pluck the strings or whatever it is. And you hear notes and chords and you hear the burgeoning of something. The giftedness is already there. Someone else climbs a tree and at the top of the tree looks out and sees the forest, and they have a golden moment of realizing how connected they are to nature and that their life is about helping nature be nature. Someone else, the first time they make love. Now, usually the first time we make love, there's something golden for everybody. But some people, it opens up a body awareness that is so core to them that involves their gifts and their passions in a deeper sense than the average person. And so here's the thing. Everybody is guaranteed one experience of this revelation of the golden quality of the deep self or soul. That's the rule on earth, near as I can tell. If you don't get that, you die. That's the old idea. But most people get it, and then it gets covered up, forgotten, or buried because it didn't match their expectation, his family's expectation, or there was something about it that created fear or a need to avoid that. And so then later in life, a person has to go back and uncover that. So I'm saying that most people walking around have had an experience of it, but have not known how to connect to it, how to value it, and how to live with it.
So what would be, we're kind of running to the end of our conversation here, and what I always like to ask people, because the show is the Aspire Possibility Show, what inspires you right now?
Well, interesting. What I'm inspired by, I'm always inspired by stories. I'm always looking for the next story. Stories just... I study stories all the time, and then stories will pop into my mind at an unexpected moment, and then I know I'm supposed to be telling that story. So then I start telling the story, and story means storehouse at some level, and what's stored inside the stories is what everybody keeps losing. And so when I tell a story, I'm being given direct knowledge from the story. Stories are vehicles of knowledge. And so I'm always inspired by stories, but lately, what I've been doing is working on rituals to help bring a sense of communal connection and soulful unity in times when everything seems to be falling apart and turning into conflict and opposition. So I'm working on the ritual side, which is, you know, story is the telling. You could say ritual is kind of like the doing of something. And I'm working on community healing rituals that are inspiring to me. So in the middle of all the conflict in the culture, soul would ask us to find ways to unify. And I don't think political unification is going to occur. And I think the easiest way to psychological unification is through ritual.
So to develop these community rituals is one of your callings, one of your passions, and what also gives you hope is that's the next part of this. What, you know, after what inspires us and what gives us hope, sometimes they're the same thing. Are the same thing for you? What gives you hope? Is it what inspires you?
Well, here's the thing. So the word hope, it's a big word in America. Barack Obama ran on that word. Many politicians run on that word. Americans are
It is overused,
future-looking.
I got to admit.
So what I always think is our first hopes are false hopes. They're naive hopes. You know, geez, I hope I could be the best musician in the world, you know, or I hope, you know, whatever it is. And those hopes, we're supposed to lose those hopes because they're naive and they're immature and they're not going to bring us genuine life. So then when you lose hope, the word is despair, to be without hope, desperare. And so then it's out of despair that a second level of hope occurs. And I think the core quality of the second level of hope is imagination. That is to say, Hope that has genuine imagination can change your life. Hope that is just wishful thinking will actually not move your life in a meaningful way. So I'm kind of thinking of what I call second level of hope or deeper hope, or you could say the hope of the soul rather than the hope of the ego. In that sense, I get hope, that kind of deeper hope, I get it in the middle of watching how people become peaceful, watching how people become more loving in the midst of doing a communal ritual, a community ritual. But I also get it from watching how people light up and get connected when they're hearing a story and when we're working with the story. So both of those things give me kind of the nourishment of that deeper hope that is both rich with imagination and with connection.
What's your biggest challenge? What's your biggest challenge, Michael Mead's biggest challenge right now?
Well, that's a good question. Thank you for asking that. All for whatever, the 35 or more years that I've been doing community work, I use story and soul and everything to do community work. And I've worked with the most traumatized people I could find, refugees, battle veterans, at-risk kids, gang kids, homeless people. I've gone where the trauma is because you can learn so much there. And what's happened now is the trauma is almost everywhere now. It's like we're all marginalized by the modern world. And so the challenge I'm having is how to go from a hands-on kind of person and a let's be in the same space and feel the essence of a story together kind of person to putting that same energy out or similar energy out using podcasts and publishing stuff. In other words, I'm experimenting with the idea of trying to get deep ideas of the soul and of myth and imagination out to a wider audience. And that's challenging to me because I love and have practiced the way of being physically connected with people and working in proximity where you can feel the power of the story and you can enter it physically, emotionally, as well as mentally. And so that's a bit of a challenge. It's not as nourishing to me, I will say that.
Right.
But the feedback is more people need meaningful stories, and so
and you
I'm
can reach
seeing
more
it
people.
As that's the idea, and that never was a particular goal of mine. But now it seems to be a more valuable goal because there are so many people hurting.
It's not going to get better. Yeah, I think we're all kind of experienced that. We have a message, and we want to share a message. We want to make a difference, and if not many people hear our message, the impact we have, we're not going to really realize the potential impact that's out there. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Michael Mead of Mosaic Voices. And so tell us a little bit about how people can get a hold of you, Michael, and your website, and if they want to find out about workshops you're doing and community rituals, how they go about doing that.
So the website is Mosaic Voices, all one word, .org. Or if you just, you know, Google Michael Mead, it'll take you there. And what's there are DVDs and CDs and books and essays that have been published and podcasts and all kinds of stuff that address the many, many themes that are possible to look at through myth and imagination. And then if people get interested, there's stuff there for free. And then there's also all kinds of things people can purchase. And then the purchases they make or donations they might make go in to bringing stories to people that are hurting or bringing rituals to communities that need healing. And so we're using the modern ways of putting things out, but we're really using ancient practices, which would always involve healing as well as using imagination to solve problems.
Well, I want to thank you for being my guest on the Inspire Possibility Show, and sharing this time with me and our listeners, and I found it a very fascinating conversation. And thank you for your commitment to and your choice, your courage for being on this path and also listening to your soul to kind of do what you're called to do. And what I'd like to do is as a way of thanking you for being the guest here is send you a copy of my book, The Soul of Uncertainty, which I think you'll enjoy. So thanks again.
Well, great.
For...
Thank you, Mark, and thank you for the good work you're doing.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to Inspire Possibility Show with Mark Susnow. To learn more about Mark Susnow, go to inspirepossibility.com and click on the contact button. Schedule a complimentary visit with Mark or email him at mark@inspirepossibility.com. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine.